So you want to talk with the author of The God Part of the Brain, Matthew Alper? Well, it's your turn next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Matthew, if a human who has this, according to you, hardwired in his brain, what happens if he's brain damaged? Does he start thinking something else? What goes on?
Well, it depends what part of your brain is damaged. I mean, if people suffer a stroke or have a tumor, sometimes it impinges on a certain region in the brain. It might affect someone's language abilities, which is why some people during stroke, it often affects either the angular gyrus or the Broca's area, so it affects linguistic comprehension or speech ability. It could affect your musical ability, your math ability. These are called psychoorganic syndromes, when the brain is actually changed by some type of trauma or injury. And there are people been reported who've suffered from religious psychoorganic syndromes, who've been bumped in the head and came out of it the next day. People who are very religious, who after being banged in the head, suffering from brain trauma, lost their religious propensities and no longer really cared. At the same time, you've had people who, you know, who weren't religious at all and got banged in the head, and all of a sudden, like, just were infused with the feeling of God. So absolutely, that can play a role.
Let's go to the phones. We'll pick it up by going east to the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Good morning.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
Hey, good. Listen, I got something here. I don't know how he's going to be able to explain this away. Listen, I had a personal experience with the medium, just like you see on the television show, only here in Philadelphia. Somebody that, works with the Philadelphia police, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I had my apartment robbed. I didn't know who did it. She told me she never saw me before in my life. I said nothing. She told me who stole my stuff. Now, I'm just telling you that to, you know, give her a little bit of credibility as to her ability. The end of the half hour, as I'm putting my coat on, working my way to the door, she, out of the clear blue, says to me, now, keep in mind, I'm there crying out, who stole my stereo? Me and Bodies of Water in this lifetime was the furthest thing from my conscious mind. But she, out of the clear blue, said to me, the reason you have difficulty with Bodies of Water in this lifetime is that you met two violent deaths at sea in the British Navy in previous lifetimes. Now, how did she pick up on that? How can you sit there and tell us all that there's nothing beyond what we see in this reality here? There's nothing beyond that. How did that woman who never saw me before, just like you see John Edwards on television, those people that he's talking to, they say nothing. He does all the talking. So they're not building on something that you're saying. They're not tricking you. They're tuned into something that is beyond what we can see in this reality here. I'm not stupid. I'm not insane. I have total control of my mind. Yet this woman told me about two previous lifetimes in the British Navy. And George, I have no interest in going in oceans in this lifetime. All during my life, going down to Wildwood during the summer, I had no interest in going into the ocean. I'd go to the beach, but I would always try to sneak away to go to motel pools, trying to get over this problem I was having with the ocean, try to teach myself how to swim. After years, I said, the hell with it. Why fight it? I just have no interest in oceans, bays, rivers. I don't mind dipping my toes in a pool where I can see to the bottom. But how did that woman pick up on that and come up with this fantastic story if she's not tuned into something that we can't see in this reality?
All right, well, let's find out. Matthew, are you accepting of the fact that some people could be intuitive or psychic? Or do you rule that out too, I guess?
I don't believe in psychic ability. Every time I've seen skeptics do a true investigation of people who've claimed to be psychics, they are always debunked. And, you know, if we had psychics out there, then all of the crimes that have us completely perplexed in every newscast would be solved daily, because we'd have, like, the best of the best working with the FBI and the CIA, and there's no drama and no crime that wouldn't be solved.
I understand what
you're saying. So I can't really, and I can't, I mean, You could put 10 million people on the phone, each one with their own, you know, how could you explain the fact that, you know, the night after my grandmother passed away, her favorite dish fell off the wall and shattered, and I knew it was a symbol. Basically, I can't comment on hearsay because I wasn't there when the woman spoke to you. I don't know what exactly, what exchange took place. I believe
I'm telling you exactly as it happened. I'm not embellishing the story. I'm not making anything up.
Well, you know what? Sometimes you know the game telephone, where you spend, if you have the same sentence passed through 10 people. I think sometimes we play telephone with ourselves.
No.
Listen, I don't want to, I couldn't even begin to contradict what you're saying.
I'm not
suggesting you are. All I'm saying is I can't comment on your personal experience. I just can't. I wasn't there. I'd have to have been there. I'd have to know all the facts. I'd have to have seen it. And again, I'm a scientist. I need to have every little part of some type of experiment cross-referenced, checked, overseen by a team of scientists so that no little fault goes unnoticed, et cetera. So to have just one person say, I'd be believing 10 million stories. I'd have one person who came out of the desert and saw the ghost of this one, and this one who saw Allah, and this one who saw Zeus, and this one who saw Buddha. And I could say, okay, I believe in all of them. And I'm not meaning to take away from your experience, but rather than believe all of them, I would choose to just say, you know what, if that's your story, let's bring you to Harvard University or some school where they have a lab and they do research on these things and try to get to the bottom of it, because without the scientific backing, to me, it's just hearsay, and I can't comment on it. So it's your experience. It was obviously a very powerful experience for you, however you interpret it. However you interpreted it, whatever the reality is, though, I can't speak on.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on with Matthew Alper. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go
My
ahead, please.
My name is Brandon. I'm from Orange. Hi, George. Hi, Matthew.
Ah, you're in California.
Hey, Brandon.
Okay.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, actually, Matthew, I first read your book about almost 10 years ago, and I've actually found your work quite inspirational, and I agree with actually about 90% of what you're saying, and it's actually been kind of, in an ironic sense, a guiding light the past few years of my life as far as my approach to God and my own kind of dealing with my own atheism. But where I kind of disagree with you is in the idea that this idea of God is serves as a, like, a biological function of human, of human beings. Mm-hmm. I think that what it is actually, I believe, and I think that your empirical data actually kind of might support this too, that what we're dealing with is actually a combination of a kind of an addictive behavior, mm-hmm. and also a combination of that as well as kind of an evolution of memes, kind of in regards to what I think Dawkins talks about, and I think it's the selfish gene, I can't recall, but I think the combination of those two factors results in what you would call the function of religiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And because the only problem I have with your overall argument is that I don't really see a kind of a biological need for the belief in God. I think that it doesn't really serve as a somewhat of a survival mechanism. I think that it's more or less, it's kind of baggage from other kind of what we might call psychoevolutionary traits, and that's just kind of my belief. And I would kind of like to know more about, or kind of like to know more how it is that you see this kind of fear of death, mm-hmm. as requiring the function of religiosity. I don't think that it really requires that. I think it's just leftover baggage from other factors.
Well, first of all of the neurophysiological and genetic research out there would contradict that it's a meme and not a gene. As far as why it evolved, I mean, that's all theory. That falls into the realm of theory. obviously we can't trace back to the origins of these parts of the brain. Again, my sense is, given if we look at what are the universals in these beliefs, well, the universals are belief in a soul and the belief in the preservation of that soul or spirit in some form of an afterlife, would suggest that an integral part of this religious impulse is to believe that there's something more than the physical part of us and that it survives death. So I believe the awareness of death probably played an integral role in the evolution of this particular adaptation. So again, that's all theory, and people could come up with 100 theories for why. Some people have come up with like the social theory that it evolved in us because we needed, as George was saying earlier, it helps bond the community. It gives us a set of, you know, of common laws and customs to help guide us and strengthen us as a group. That's one approach. Again, my take is that it probably has something to do with the awareness of death. All life is wired for self-preservation. The first wiring is avoid death. Avoid those things which threaten our existence. And all of a sudden, humans come into the picture, and for the first time, an animal realizes that it's going to die and there's nothing it can do about it. And I do believe that that is what made us what Freud called the neurotic animal, that for the first time humans became the first what we could call existential animal, the first creature to be aware of its own limitations and the fact that in the vast span of time, not only are we meaningless, but we're not even going to exist. We're just going to be nothingness. We're going to just, you know, whatever nothingness would imply, which in itself is probably its own particular type of terror. So I believe that that was probably the prompting mechanism that forced the selection of this. But I agree, it's all that part is theory. But that's pretty much my take on it, and I'm for now sticking to it.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, I'm calling from Wisconsin.
Sure.
Right now we're in the frozen tundra, but my question is about energy, and I was told that our bodies are made up of energy and that energy is a force that you can't kill energy. So if when you die, what happens to the energy in living beings or living things? Where does this energy go?
Mm-hmm. Well, what you're referring to, and it's one of the most sort of, you know, misinterpreted laws of science, which is it's the first law of thermodynamics. And the first law of thermodynamics, conservation of energy, basically says that energy can neither be created nor destroyed. As we know from Einstein, equals mc squared. Mass or matter is energy in flux. And basically, with whatever energy exists in the physical universe, none can spontaneously appear and none can spontaneously disappear. So this is true. The energy that you make up right now will always exist till the end of time. However,
so you're not dying. Something lives on.
Right. The energy lives on, but the energy won't necessarily be you. So for instance, you know, once one dies and is then filtered off into the, you know, disintegration process and becomes a combination of soil and nitrogen and all of these things that will disintegrate into, absolutely, the energy that we're made of will still exist. As a matter of fact, every 7 years, every cell in your body is recycled. So as cells die and new ones regenerate to replace them, every 7 years, there is no one cell that was the same 7 years earlier. We're like a new being. In a sense, you could say we've shed off a whole shell's worth of energy. But our self, our consciousness is sustained because the brain is kept up. But again, once the brain stops and once the energy that makes up your brain, which is the neurons in it, disintegrate and become soil and gas and a million other things, your energy will exist. But you as a conscious entity will not. So, yeah, it's true. In a way, our physical beings, our physical beings, our hair falls out. We leave trails of ourselves behind all the time. But are those hairballs that are gathered in a corner of our room, is that really us? No. Is it our energy? Yes, it once was. But just like our skin and our bones and our brain and our heart will one day be the equivalent of those, the hair that falls out of us and is left behind, that hair is no more us than our brain will one day be when it disintegrates. So, yes, your energy will exist, but your consciousness will not. So, for me, you know, it doesn't really give me much consolation to know that in a million years I'll still exist as cosmic dust. You know, it won't be me, so I don't really care. But yes, it's true that that is the law of conservation of energy. It can't be created nor destroyed. And if one takes solace in the fact that in some form we will all be here, not as we are now, and not even as a thinking entity, but in some form we will all be here till the end of time. And in a sense, everything we're made of was here from the beginning of time. So if one wants to be nostalgic in that way, we're actually pretty incredible creatures because everything we're made of has existed for, you know, countless trillions of years. I mean, it's not even trillions. We're talking about infinite proportions that we can't even calculate. But and one day we will absorb back into the maelstrom of reality and, you know, again, be dust. But as they say, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. But unless there is a soul that will survive the death of our physical bodies, we as we know ourselves will no longer exist. And I think that's what we're all hoping will exist one day after the body dies. But unfortunately, at least from my outlook, that's not going to be the case.
But I promise, though, if you pass on, if there is a hereafter, you'll come back and tell us?
I'm going to come on the George Norrie show.
You got that right.
You've got an interview set.
You've got an open book here, Matthew. Let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, it's Michael in Atlanta.
Sure, Michael. Go ahead, please.
I haven't heard all the shows, so I don't have everything to work with, but a few minutes ago, a caller was talking about a medium experience that he had, and the guest made the statement that he didn't accept anything with mediums or ESP because there was no scientific evidence for it. And I would just like to point out, and he said that being a scientist, he couldn't accept that because he required the experimentation. And I'd just like to point out, being a scientist requires having an open mind and doing your research first before you take a position. And Gary Schwartz has done extensive double-blind studies with mediums and has produced consistent results. Stefan Schwartz, different, I don't think they're related, hosts the Schwartz Report every fall, works with remote viewers, and he finds historical ruins, you know, archaeological finds using remote viewers. And someone asked him, had anybody ever done any double-blind studies? And he said, there's been more double-blind studies done on remote viewers and remote viewing than any drug ever approved by the FDA, and it consistently has shown accurate results. And I have to say my own experience in those areas is pretty extensive, and I know people who are very focused on results, not...
Well, you know, personally, I believe if that were the case, then every major school in the world, from the Sorbonne to Cambridge to Harvard, would have, like, the School of Paranormal Thought.
On our next Coast to Coast program, investigator Robert Duncan joins us. He's talking about people being used randomly as guinea pigs to gauge the effectiveness of human-directed energy weapons. I'm looking forward to that. We'll be back in a moment. Final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll go right back to the phones with our guest, Matthew Alper. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there.
Good morning, George. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning.
This is Brian in Seattle.
Hi, Brian. Thank you.
Hey, I've been listening to Matthew for years since Art interviewed him back in the late 90s, and I got to say I'm very impressed. I mean, he makes certainly an excellent argument. He has so many points that make a lot of sense to just explain all these things, but I don't know. I mean, there are so many things that are unexplainable, though. And what I want to say is, you know, hearing his arguments have inspired me to even push further with what I've done, which is pushing in the field of ITC, instrumental transcommunication.
Now, tell me about that.
Well, it's basically trying an approach with any variety of electronic devices. I mean, I've made my own instruments, nothing technical, a lot of it's acoustic, but I've basically been able to interact with EVP. And this is I've been on radio shows before. People hear these things. In fact, it's been building up over years to where the last interview that I did, or the second to the last, we actually had real-time EVPs coming through the studio that the hosts heard. But I wanted to know what Matthew might think about that. I know what he said, that you have to have evidence, and that's been one of my pushes to build this up where, I mean, I understand. I mean, I truly value skepticism. I mean, it's very important, but when you get physical evidence like these voices that are audibly recordable and they can be reproduced, and I've been pushing at this for 9 years, and it's been building and building, I can do it more on demand. I mean, I just wonder how you can shoot that down. But the biggest problem I'm having, and it's been extremely frustrating, is people are afraid. And I've been trying for 9 years. I just went 6,000 miles to a conference. I only made 3 contacts, and every one of them dropped the ball. I can't present this to anybody significant. But it's reproducible. Matthew, what would you think about hearing voices that talk about heaven, call you by name, answer your questions, give you information you couldn't consciously know, and yet you would be able to hear it with your ears?
All I would suggest is that you take your devices to either some science lab or some university and have them test it out. And if you can reproduce the kinds of results that you're describing, then I'll look forward to seeing you on the cover of Time magazine in the near future. But
let me put this out there to a number of ears, because I've been trying for years. I get very shut down. Nobody will listen. Nobody will give me the chance. There are archives that anybody can go check on the internet to hear some of these voices. I can
right,
do this.
But I mean, anyone could put a tape of anything on the internet.
That's why you're gonna have to
take it to, like, you know.
I can't get anybody willing to let me do that. That's frustrating.
You know, go to your local university. Say, I have something, a device that kind of connects me with a paranormal ability, and I want to have it proven, and to do so, I would like to have it tested and researched by students. And I'm sure that you'll find.
I've made a lot of phone calls. I have not gotten any takers.
Well, call your local university. There'll be students who will be glad to put it up to the test.
I'll tell you what we'll do for you, Brian. I'm going to put you on hold. Why don't you give your information to Tommy, and let's see if we can,
through this program, help you. One last thing, though?
Sure.
Matthew, like you said about why isn't there a Nobel Prize for remote viewers, maybe there's a fear factor there, too. I mean, I know this firsthand, and it's been going on.
Well,
for
if you
years.
Know any, I'd love to hear, you know, if they could give me a nice description of the room that I'm sitting in right now. That would be kind of entertaining. So to all you remote viewers out there in Radio Land, if any of you can remote view into my room right now and tell me what I'm wearing and what's around me, then you win the prize.
Okay, we're going to put him on hold. We'll get his information and see if we can find some authentic university or study group to investigate what he's done. Because I do agree with you, Matthew. If one makes claims, one needs to be tested.
Mm-hmm.
Simple as that. Let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Oh, hi. This is Elaine from Long Island.
Hi, Elaine. Thank you.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've been listening this evening, and what it seems that the skeptics, which my idea of a skeptic is someone who deals in fact and not belief. However, Matt's conversation tonight was peppered with his beliefs, not necessarily his fact and his hard wiring, which actually I do believe in. But he's been peppered in so many beliefs of what. Therefore, you know, his skepticism to me is a little raw. That it's, you know, again, it's a belief system that he's working through, which is what people work through in spirituality. And What I wanted to say
is... Do you believe a scientist believes in his science? So that, like, when Thomas Edison created the electric light, he believed in it?
Yeah.
All I'm really laying out, I didn't have the time to go through all of the neurophysiology and all of the genetic science. I have a book of 300 pages full of it. But for the most part, it's really not my beliefs that I've been, you know, offering this evening. It's pretty much like sociobiological and neurophysiological theory. And there's a whole science, as George, you know, said, called neurotheology. And you can look it up on the internet, and it's being studied in every major university. And really, all I am is I'm one of the advocates of neurotheology. I mean, believe that it's, you know, what I've been discussing is my own belief system, absolutely. A disbelief system is a belief system. But unlike exactly. someone who says Zeus exists, who exactly. really has not put Zeus into an MRI, I can point to humans who were put in MRIs, and I can discuss the parts of their brain that lit up. And that's all I have to offer.
Right. Well, that's what I wanted to say, that I do, after many years of searching and researching, I do believe in your hardwire, that theory to me, of course. Nothing's new under the sun. People have done the same thing from day one. It's just that the evolution has opened up different avenues and different materials. But the thing that I wanted to call and say was that the piece I feel that's being missed is that in the hardwire, in the cosmos of it all, there's a completion. There's a day and a night. There's a black and a white. There's a yin and a yang. There's a humanity and there's a spirituality. It's a completion. And that's what makes the human being a being, a whole. So therefore, one part of you is your humanity and your hardwiring. The other part, which completes you, is your spirituality, which, again, is nothing but a faith-based...
Okay. Well, thank you for sharing your belief.
A faith-based reality. Right. So that's all I'm just trying to say, to open that up also, is that, you know...
Well, I know the alternative.
You're just half. You're just a yin. Where's the yang? I don't understand. But yet... We've been shown that there is a yin and a yang. It's in nature. Nature's yin and yang. Nature's day and night. It's a completion. And I just don't see where your completion is. And that's really what I want to call about.
All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, Wildcard Line, your turn. Thanks for holding so long.
Sure. Matthew, I want to ask you, your theory, and I'll take it and run with it, seems to be a little constricting confining it to religion, a supreme being, God, etc. Couldn't you just extrapolate that out to be anything that people believe in, such as the state, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler? People lived, died for those people and the state. Earlier you had said if people believed in your hardwired religiosity and everybody believed it, there would be no more wars. I think that's a joke.
I don't think that if I said if everyone believed it, there'd be no wars. But as far as what you're talking about, people sometimes believing in or showing devotion, fervent devotion, in which they'll even kill for a state or the name of a person, things that aren't spiritually or religiously affiliated, I agree with that.
Right, that's what
I'm
saying.
There are parts of the brain that make us loyal as a social organism. We bond around a variety of structures.
Right.
Some of them are religious, some of them are nationalistic.
Right.
Some of them are territorial, right. Some of them are familial.
That's what I meant by extrapolation. You could take it further than just spiritual, God, higher being. State.
Well, that's just if you're talking about devotion. What I'm discussing, my sole purpose, and there will be other authors who will write about the devotion wiring of the brain and how humans are a nationalistic and a territorial animal.
Is it all the same thing, whether it's...
Because Stalin was real and Hitler was
everybody
real.
Everybody died for him.
People have died for it.
Yeah,
but people have died. People have died for any number of things. People have died in their automobiles. They've died in the name of sports and food
now.
And everything.
You're getting off base. People don't live and die for their automobiles, but they will live and die for the Fuhrer or Uncle Joe.
Well,
without believing in God or any religiosity.
I didn't say it's the sole source of where people die from. I'm just suggesting it would be an unnecessary offshoot for me to discuss the secular reasons that people die for certain causes.
All I'm really seeking, which is a religion.
It's not a religion. A religion implies a spiritual belief system.
No, global warming is the religion. They have supplanted it. It's the same thing as
if you think global warming's a religion, then, you know, all the power to you, but good luck looking it up in the religious registry.
Well, you know what I'm saying. I mean,
not really. I'm saying that this one of the definitions of religiosity is that it incorporates a spiritual attribute, that a belief that there's some transcendent reality underlying. And yeah, there might have been people who believed that Stalin was God or Hitler was God, in which case the charisma these people had somehow stimulated their spiritual sensibilities. That's a different story.
It's the same thing. It dovetails perfectly.
Okay, well then write a book on it.
Why should I write a book? I just gave away the whole secret.
Well, okay. Thank you for sharing.
Thanks. Appreciate you being part of the program. Next up, we'll go to our East of the Rockies line. You're on Coast to Coast. Good morning.
Hey, is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Oh, well, good morning. This is Mary Kay from New York City.
Sure.
When my little sister was about 3 or 4 years old, she said something really cool about reincarnation that I wanted to share. It was a typical afternoon. We were sitting around the kitchen table, and all of a sudden she looks up and she says, if you don't get it right the first time, you can come back. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, you know, life. You can do it over again if you want to. So Hello? Oh, sorry, I thought we got cut off. Yeah, I thought that was pretty interesting. Did you get
right,
that?
But I would hardly consider that proof of reincarnation. I would say it was, you know, some facet of a child's imagination. Again, it could be any number of things, but to suggest that's proof that we, you know, that we have future and past lives, again, I'm gonna have to be the skeptic here and say that doesn't say anything to me that's, you know, going to create a light bulb. There's no...
Yeah, understood. There was actually a couple more things I really quickly wanted to say. I had a best friend, Bob, who passed away a few years ago. On my first birthday without him, there was a fresh flower bouquet on my front steps. I live in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
It was there all day long. You know, when it got dark, I kind of figured, you know, thumbs up, you know, thank you, Bob. The next birthday without him, I was walking down the street, walking down First Avenue, feeling a little sorry for myself, having a poor me day. And I thought, you know, yeah, you didn't even give me anything on my birthday this year, Bob. A couple blocks later, I saw something in the middle of First Avenue a few blocks ahead of me. And as I'm getting closer, I saw what it was and tried not to lunge for it before I could get at it. It was a plastic bag with about $150 worth of pot in it. And it was, you know, very nice to receive it. Again, that's not, you know, proof, but every year things like that happen. This year I had kind of said to my dad one night, you know, hey, don't want to bother you, but if you ever want to, you know, come and say hi, I'm here. The next morning I woke up, something fell. At the base of my bed I have a mannequin with things pinned in it. A rosary had fallen off of it and I, like, jumped 3 feet over, and right next to it was another pin that had one of my father's mailing labels, one of his mailing labels on it. So things like that happen over and over again. You know, you kind of learn that there's more out there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, again, that's certainly one way to interpret events. I would interpret it otherwise. I think that if we look for things, we will find them. If you go out in your day thinking, I wonder if there's any significance to the number, and you can pick any number, 4, 7, 9, you will find nines in everything. You will find that it's 9 stairs to go, you know, to your friend's house, and there are 9 circles on the Starbucks container that you're holding, and you'll find nines all over the place. If you say to yourself, show me a sign, something's going to fall off the wall. Something's going to happen that on another day you might consider mundane, but since you asked for something, you can reinterpret reality to suit your spiritual needs, which is the way I think that the brain operates. So that would be my interpretation of your experience.
Time for one or two more questions. That's it. Wildcard Line, welcome to the show.
Thank you, George. I treasure your show. I really enjoy it.
Well, thank you.
Hey, I was watching the there's like the History Channel or Discovery Channel, and there was this one scientist that thought that this alien abduction thing was a bunch of hooey. He suspected that it was something to do with just kind of like you were talking about the temporal lobe, and he actually built this chamber kind of like that helmet you were describing, and he would have people, as other people were watching, they'd go in this chamber, and they would stimulate the temporal lobe, and then they would interview the people after this session, and they would all swear that there was someone else in that room, that there was someone pulling their leg, or that there was some spirit in there.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought that the alien abduction thing, if it was true, there would have been writings from the 15th or 16th century saying, hey, I was abducted by an alien. But he said, no, what they had in those days was, I was visited by a succubus, or I was visited by an incubus. That was their interpretation of this. And he credited that to some kind of temporal lobe disturbance.
Mm-hmm.
There was also a scientist up in Berkeley. He was working late at night in his lab, and he got this eerie feeling that there was a spirit or someone watching him, a ghost. And he left, came back being a scientist. He wanted to understand why he felt that way. They came and they figured out, they isolated. There was this machine that was putting out this noise that the human ear couldn't detect, but it still impacted the temporal lobe. When they turned that machine off, that feeling went away. And then he figured out, well, organs, the reason that organs have that eerie sound is there's tones that the human ear cannot distinguish, but yet it still stimulates the temporal lobe in such a way that it gives us that weird spiritual kind of eerie feeling. Mm-hmm. So I really think you're onto something there with the temporal lobe.
Well, Matthew, we're running out of time, but it's going to come down to, of course, the faith, the belief, or the not. I think the two camps will always have their own specific views. Matthew,
absolutely.
Thanks so much for being on the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being a gentleman. And even though I'm sure you disagree with a lot of what I'm saying, you know, you gave me a perfect forum to discuss these ideas. And just one thing about the book, for those of you who are going on to Amazon to purchase it, I implore that you get the hardcover edition. That's the new one with the color cover. It's got all the updated material and new chapters, and I hope you enjoy.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.